than a decade of defunding since the financial crash. This has led to a real terms wage cut for staff. The whole population, the health needs have gone up. We have trouble keeping hold of staff, and we've also lost significant capacity with the NHS through privatisation. So we don't have enough beds, we don't have enough staff, and the staff we do have are being treated appallingly.
The health service is also coping with an ageing population. A large number of people now live with chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes.
The COVID-19 pandemic severely tested the NHS, with its aftermath still posing serious challenges. Health officials and experts warn for the UK's National Health Service to survive, the next government should declare it a national emergency. Saipur is up, London.
India says it will enact the Citizenship Amendment Act that provides fast-track naturalization for multiple religious groups who fled to India from Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan before 2014. The law, however, excludes Muslims from those countries. Back in 2019, law's approval sparked deadly protests across the country and was halted since. The Muslim minority in India fears the government is using this law and other similar laws to widen crackdown on them.
India introduced this bill in 2016 with the aim of granting citizenship to what it calls a persecuted section of refugees. However, the bill has become one of the most controversial issues across the country since it excludes Muslims from availing citizenship. Critics accuse the ruling BJP of targeting a particular community on the basis of faith, which experts call unconstitutional.
Commentators also question the exclusion of persecuted religious minorities from other regions such as Tibet, Sri Lanka and Myanmar. India's Interior Ministry has said in a statement, those eligible can now apply online for Indian citizenship. The issue has been one of the key pledges of Indian Prime Minister since assuming office in 2014. The new legislation makes changes to more than six decades old Indian citizenship law.
It's unfortunate for us that we are not part of this new law, despite the fact we have faced worse persecution any community has faced so far. We have still hope one day India will accept us on the ground of humanity.
Opposition political parties have accused the ruling party of influencing the elections, saying the move is to polarize the voters, considering its timing. More than 200 petitions challenging the law are still pending before the court of law.
We thank India they provide us shelter. It's an act of kindness, but we urge this country not to abandon us, knowing the fact we have seen deadly violence and persecution.
India, home to roughly 200 million Muslims, have recently seen targeted attacks and vicious hate campaigns. Critics accuse the ruling party of mixing religion with politics, resonating with India's majority. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Russia Navy warship, and China Navy warship. This is Iranian Navy warship 235, Italian Channel 16. Do you read me? Over.
The Maritime Security Belt 2024 has officially kicked off with Russian and Chinese vessels entering Iran's territorial waters south of the country on Tuesday. The naval and airborne units of Iran's army and the IRGC, along with their Chinese and Russian counterparts, will participate in various operations during this exercise. Naval delegations from Azerbaijan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Oman and South Africa have also taken part as observer states. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries as well as the observer states reviewed different phases of the exercise on maps and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of Iran, Russia and China held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
Upholding peace and security in the north of Indian Ocean and having a specialized cooperation in combating piracy and terrorism in our region are among the main goals of this exercise. We are constantly working to improve this cooperation.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security while also deepening their practical cooperation. 2024 is the fifth consecutive year that the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy is hosting countries participating in the Maritime Security Belt drills in the northern Indian Ocean region.
This year's naval drills have kicked off under the motto, Together for Peace and Security, with participating countries highlighting the importance of jointly safeguarding regional security. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
This is not the first time Palestinian people are spending Ramadan under Israeli aggression. In 2014, the Israeli regime also waged a destructive war on Gaza during the holy month. However, the current genocidal war is unprecedented in terms of its colossal casualties. Many Palestinians have become orphans and widows and lost their children. The memory of their loved ones will stay with them in Ramadan.
The life here is so difficult. The holy month of Ramadan is around the corner and we are still displaced from our homes and our families are torn apart. We have nothing to eat for iftar. I'm originally from Gaza. I've lost 37 members of my family. They were so close to my heart. Every time I remember them, my gut is wrenched and I become so sad and furious.
With markets destroyed and goods scarce, Gazans don't know where their iftar meals will come from, which means more suffering and agony. The vast majority of the people live in small tents amid the starvation that has already claimed the lives of several Palestinian children.
The situation in Gaza is very difficult. There is no food. The people are struggling to find anything to eat with flour scarce. Here in the south, they queue in long lines for food. Even those who attempt to get anything from the aid trucks are putting their lives at risk as Israeli soldiers open fire on them. I don't know what we're going to do in Ramadan.
Palestinians' catastrophe doesn't stop with the loss of their relatives. It is deepened by the full-scale destruction that has become palpable in every corner of Gaza, including mosques, which means they won't be able to say their prayers and worships as usual. Even if their mosques hadn't been destroyed, it would still be impossible for them to perform their prayers under the incessant Israeli bombardments.
The humanitarian conditions are completely disastrous. The people were displaced from several parts of Gaza, including the northern and central areas of the Strip. It is literally catastrophic. There is no source of income or food, and the people are completely relying on the small amounts of donation provided by a limited numbers of charity institutions. In addition to that, mosques have been completely destroyed by Israeli warplanes and we will never be able to pray in them.
While some aid has been trickling into Gaza, it's minuscule compared to the needs of the Palestinians. With Ramadan arriving, more assistance cannot come soon enough for them.
As the whole Muslim nation welcomes Ramadan, Palestinians are wondering why they have been abandoned by many Muslim leaders to face the Israeli campaign of death and starvation. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The Iranian National Oil and Gas Company says that this is the most strategic project in the history of Iran's oil and gas industry and its long-sought empowerment of domestic entities. Under this project, 90 trillion cubic feet of gas and 2 billion barrels of gas condensates will be available for use. Top Iranian companies, Petropars, Oil Industries Engineering and Construction, Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Headquarters, Mapna Group, and a consulting company are the contractors of the mega project.
In the subject matter of the development and increase of capacities of the gas and oil refineries, we witnessed the second phase of Abadan refinery with the capacity of 210,000 barrels, which helped the production and supply of gas in the country. In the 14th phase of the South Pars refineries, 50 million cubic feet of gas is produced per day, which again adds to the capacity of gas production in the country.
The massive project has created an opportunity to kickstart economic prosperity and employment in the face of unilateral Western sanctions. This has also allowed Iranian producers and companies to engage greatly in the economic growth and industrial development of the country and neutralize the sanctions.
Today, all Iranian people should witness the fact that the surrounding nations trust the Iranian National Oil Company and the relative competent companies and contractors and do rely on them, because they know well that the South Pass was built by Iranian companies, and the day that they thought that it was impossible to do so without the help and presence of foreigners, that exact day was the day that South Pass became what it is today.
While sanctions have forced the governing bodies to change their attitude towards domestic companies and entrust them with tasks, it should be noted that Iranian producers are not perennial supporters of sanctions. Rather, they would like to interact and acquire world-class technologies from foreign companies to empower themselves.
With contracts for developing oil and gas fields signed and projects for boosting pressure in South Pars gas field being started, Iran is experiencing yet another success in the mega gas project to exploit the immense gas field. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
In the limelight.
Palestinians abducted by Israeli regime forces since the start of the war are returning to Gaza with harrowing accounts of mock executions, constant beatings, and humiliating mistreatment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the third part, please. Middle East I wrote, Omar Mahmoud Abdul Qader Samud had also been forced to seek refuge in a school with memories of his family after their house was destroyed by an airstrike on November 14th. After several weeks, Israeli regime troops came to the school and abducted Samud, his wife, and their children, including their two-year-old son. Samud said, "They handcuffed us and blindfolded us and took us to a nearby hill. Tanks were roaming around us, creating a deadly scene of horror and fear. In those moments, you think you will die 1,000 times. Samud said he remained blindfolded and handcuffed for the entire 42 days of his detention, barely being given enough food to survive. He said, "The soldiers forced us to kneel for 24 hours. They would storm into the barracks where we were kept as hostages, make a lot of noise with their iron bars, kicking and breaking everything. The temperature was freezing as the cell was made of iron, very similar to cages used for animals. The troops' aim was to torture us, to break us, to show us who is the boss, and that our lives depended on them. Prisoners who raise their heads risk being sent to the ghost room," Samud said. He said, "You become a ghost, unseen and unheard. They tie your hands and legs, forbid you from going to the bathroom. They deny you water and food and leave you like this for a few days." Another room was also known as disco, Samud recalled. "A troop dragged me on the floor, handcuffed, and placed me on a piece of rug. The troops sprayed freezing cold water on me and placed a fan in front of me. They would leave me for a few days without food or water or the possibility to get up and go to the bathroom. I urinated on myself and pleaded for mercy, but they didn't care. The troops would kick me on all parts of my body. Imagine yourself handcuffed on the floor with five or six troops kicking you, with their boots hitting you with weapons and bats, he said. Then they asked me to sit up. How could I possibly sit up? When I couldn't follow the orders, they would beat me even harder. They completely smashed me. I thought this nightmare would never end. Sometimes the Zionist regime troops would unleash dogs on the captive men as they were forced to lie face down on the ground, still handcuffed and blindfolded. Samud said, the Zionist regime troops would close the door and let the dogs torture us for next 2 or 3 hours. During interrogations, the abductees were restrained in their chairs by clamps on their arms and their legs. Sometimes these sessions would last from 9 a.m. until midnight. And in one of these, Samud said his toes had been broken. He said part of the torture technique was breaking the clamps while they are still on your legs. The interrogator came to remove them, but they started banging on them so fiercely that I cried out in pain. My toes were breaking, but he kept on banging them. The pain was unbearable, he said. They left me like that, my toes broken and bloodied for 20 days, lying around like a rug. I lost over 25 kilos while being held hostage, and I cannot walk because of the torture. Ali Nayef Muhammad Al-Masri, 34, was among a group of men rounded up during a night raid by the Zionist regime forces in the northern West Bank city of Qalqilya in January. Masri, who is from Gaza, and the other men had previously been working in the occupied territories but had been displaced to Qalqilya when their work permits were withdrawn at the start of the war. Following an army raid on the building where they were staying, the men were blindfolded, handcuffed, and dragged to a space alongside the fence separating the West Bank from the occupied territories. Masri said they kept us there for about a month. We were workers, but there were also sick people there, people with cancer. Some of them were elderly, also were brutalized, tortured, and humiliated. There were no regard for human life. One day, Masri was among 10 men separated by the Zionist regime troops from the rest of the detainees. The men were made to strip and kneel by the fence. He said, an army commander came and waged a psychological war against us. He shouted at his unit, kill them all, every single one of them. Then the troops started shooting and we heard live ammunition all around us. I had no idea if I was dead or alive. The men were then taken to a room for questioning. He said, the first question was, who do you know? And he showed me photos from my neighborhood. If he didn't like my answers, he would hang me by my arms, still handcuffed. My interrogation lasted for 10 days. At this time, I didn't know when it was day and when it was night. I was freezing all the time, freezing and handcuffed. Other times, Masri said his interrogator would burn cigarettes on his skin and kick him. He was made to sit on a chair that delivered electric shocks and was prevented from sleeping. He said, The troops under commander were monsters. When I asked for water, the troop would laugh, go to the corner, urinate in a plastic bottle and bring it to me to drink. When I refused, he would drop the whole thing on me. After several weeks, Mastri and other men were handcuffed and blindfolded, put on an army truck and driven for 6 hours to Karam Abu Salem crossing. He said, before they released us, they undressed us again and took our clothes. When they dropped us off there, there were 55 male detainees and 6 female detainees. They made us walk north, and after walking a long distance, the troops started shooting at us. Later, we learned that the 6 women had been kidnapped from inside Gaza and were held hostage for 3 months. We didn't know anything about them.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Holocaust on Palestinians in Gaza continues by the Zionist regime. There will be no ceasefire for the beginning of the month of Ramadan, and there seems to be no pressure on the Zionist regime. The United States and its cohorts have not only given the Zionist entity the green light to continue its genocide, but these countries are complicit, inflicting as much pain and suffering as possible. Seems to be the goal of the Zionists and their Western backers. We're going to take a look at what happened today and what has happened for the last 5.5 months on this program. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Harley Schlanger, spokesman, International Schiller Institute out of Germany. And John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Harley, let me start off with you. Did you expect this genocide to still be going on 5.5 months later?
Well, I think anyone who's listened to Joe Biden can realize that whatever he says about being more humane and stopping the killing of civilians, it means nothing. Because if the United States wanted to stop the killing, they could very quickly, by cutting off the money and cutting off the weapons and cutting off the diplomatic cover. So regardless of the fact that Biden said he wanted a ceasefire by Ramadan, that the U.S. is putting out these messages, Blinken travels there, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, all of them are saying that this is unacceptable. They know that that's not going to stop Netanyahu. And the problem is that the U.S. is giving, as you said, a green light to the Zionist regime, the Netanyahu regime, to slaughter Palestinians. Now, the other aspect of this is, what about Europe? What about the European allies, the NATO allies of the United States? There have been a few voices raised, but on the whole, the Europeans remain fully in the camp of Netanyahu. Obviously, many of them believe that the solution to the problem in the region is to drive the Palestinians out of Palestine. They won't say it, but that's what they're letting Netanyahu do. And so I'm not surprised that it's continued. I'm horrified that it is. My organization is working to do everything we can to build a movement to stop it. But so far, the Biden regime is totally committed to defending Netanyahu, despite his statements today on MSNBC that he's upset with Netanyahu.
Yeah, stay with me on that. I'm going to get to that a little bit later in the program. Now, John, did you expect that a ceasefire would be in place by the month of Ramadan?
Well, I believe that the issue of ceasefire before Ramadan, which was just lip service by the Biden, I believe that they know the Ramadan is starting tomorrow. And the Israelis, for several times, refused after meeting with the Qatari mediators and the Egyptian mediators. They refused any proposal proposed by Hamas, which is a simple proposal, is that the, well, obviously, Israel had to draw from Gaza. A ceasefire, you know, will be at the same time. And then the first week, they will start, obviously, going through exchange of prisoners. And then from there, they take it for the second phase, which is the Israelis would have to be out of Gaza completely. Now, they rejected that. Okay, they, because they wanted to give the Palestinians a break in Ramadan, so and after Ramadan they'll be ready to come back and slaughter them. They are refusing a permanent ceasefire. They wanted a ceasefire only for Ramadan. This is not acceptable for the Palestinians.
Right.
So that's why the proposal of having a ceasefire before Ramadan or for Ramadan is fair.
Right. What about that, Harley? It's actually quite mind-boggling that it is proposed, and we saw it earlier, there is a temporary ceasefire. We have a pause, and then we get back to the genocide. I mean, it is so mind-boggling, it's so dystopian just to think about this being even a possibility that they were bringing this up.
Well, that just shows the hypocrisy. I mean, the idea that you're going to stop firing for a little bit of time to get the hostages back, then you're going to go back in and continue the mass murder. The fact that no one's calling that out shows you the extent to which the West has lost all semblance of morality. Now, I just was at a briefing this afternoon at the South African embassy in Berlin, and what they said is they're going to continue to go to the International Court of Justice with one complaint after another to try and get some motion on this. But you look at what this means, even if the International Court of Justice rules that this is genocide and it should stop, it goes to the United Nations. And the U.S. continues to veto even a ceasefire resolution at the U.N. So when the U.S. says they want a ceasefire, I ask, well, what's the evidence that they really do? There's no evidence that they do. Right. They're comfortable with the destruction of the Palestinian population. And, of course, this goes back to why it is that they supported Netanyahu's efforts to break apart the unity of the Palestinians, why Netanyahu for a period of time was funding Hamas, why the Israelis were so-called caught off guard on October 7th. This is what Israel has intended to do. The ethnic cleansing has not stopped from 1948 to the present.
Okay, well, John, from a military perspective, the Zionist regime really has not been successful in Gaza. Are you surprised at the way the Palestinian resistance has inflicted harm, though, on the Zionist military?
I didn't think so, because this is not the first war, actually. The only difference between this war and previous war, this is the genocide, where they now they change the tactic of attacking civilians, bombing schools and hospitals. They know if they went, obviously, for a one-to-one fight with Hamas, they will not really be able to succeed. They tried Hamas several times before, and they failed. The only difference now is they are not attacking Hamas. per se. They are attacking the civilians and hospitals and the schools. You know, it is really a barbaric war, not a war, a barbaric genocide against the Palestinian civilians. So I'm not surprised that the Palestinians will fight to the last second, the last drop of blood to defend their own land.
Right, of course. Well, Harley, why is the U.S. playing this game as if it wants to help the Palestinians and get aid to them, but at the same time it doesn't actually stop the genocide and it actually helps with it?
Well, let me give you a slightly broader perspective where this fits, which is that we've just seen motion with the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, expanding to include a number of nations in the region, including the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Iran. Now, the importance of that is that the United States, the military-industrial complex that controls the United States, is trying to destroy the potential for a new financial system. And you see that in terms of the attacks on Russia, the attempt to destroy Russia, and now we see the attempt to create a wider regional war. For what purpose? To maintain the U.S. sole superpower status with Israel as an enforcer agent of that. My view and our view is that Israel is being used as a tool by the Anglo-American networks to maintain the unipolar order. And so, and from that standpoint, Biden, Blinken, Sullivan, they don't care one bit for the murder of Palestinian children. We saw that with Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, who praised the killing of 500,000 Iraqi children by sanctions, saying that it was worth it to get rid of Saddam Hussein. So this is the bloodthirsty mentality of the clique that controls the government in the United States and the United Kingdom. And that's why they keep vetoing these resolutions, and they cry crocodile tears about the children who are dying as they give more weapons to the Israelis to kill them.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, John, U.S. President Joe Biden on American Network on Saturday said that there is a red line for the Israeli regime in Netanyahu. Later on in the same program, he said there is no red line for the regime. What do you make of this?
I mean, you have to keep in mind one thing, that the players here, the person who controlled the whole scene is not Joe Biden. It's the Zionist lobby in Washington. Obviously, Joe Biden threw this out as election year now, and he tried to distance himself from the genocide by saying, look, we're not going to allow the Israelis attacking Rafah. Well, nearly half of Gaza Strip in the city of Rafah. They're still attacking Rafah, on the edges of Rafah. Yesterday they killed 30 people. What you mean, it's okay to slaughter other people in Khan Yunis, Bereish camp, 8 refugee camps, they're being slaughtered daily and left to starve to death. Yet he's just worried about Rafah. You know, the issue of the aid, which is, as you mentioned earlier, they are quick enough to bomb the Hodeidah in Yemen, Hodeidah Airport. They can bomb anywhere, but they cannot drop aids to the Palestinians. Most of the aids was dropped by the Jordanians in the sea. where the Palestinians had to go to the sea to fish the aid and the Zionist Navy there, killing them on the water. So it's really hypocrisy of the Biden by actually saying, you know, we have a red line. He cannot cross the red line in Rafah, but we do have a red line because we cannot really abandon Israel. Well, he's sending daily supply of military equipment to Israel to kill Palestinians. So why is Rafah only? You know, nearly 780,000 Palestinians in Rafah. Why is Rafah only where there's 750,000 in the central of Gaza and in north of Gaza? They left there to starve to death.
Well, Harley, is the Zionist regime and the regime in Washington basically one and the same?
Well, let me take a step back and make a point that I think is important. The American people are starting to turn against this war. They're seeing the footage, the social media coverage, and we saw the results of even the Democratic Party rebelling against Biden in the Super Tuesday primaries. It's not enough, but it indicates that there are people in the United States who don't agree with this policy. And you see internationally, when the South Africans brought this motion to the International Court of Justice, 55 nations, including the Organization of Islamic Countries, the African Union, and others, testified against Israel, against the Zionists, as carrying out a genocide policy. So there's opposition to it, but not inside the U.S. military-industrial complex. They are totally tied in with the same banks and financial institutions that run Israel. And, you know, the question that some people have is the Zionist lobby running the United States. Well, the Zionist lobby is essentially the corporate cartels of banks and defense sector companies and others that want war. They don't care if it's in Ukraine or Israel. They've done their damnedest over the years to try and portray every Palestinian as a terrorist to justify the attack on Palestine. And so most Americans don't know the story of the colonial occupation of Palestine going back beyond 1948 to the whole Balfour Declaration and so on.
Right.
So as a result, the American people let Biden lie and let him get away with it, although, as I said, there is a resistance building to that.
Well, John, since the U.S. and Israeli policy seems to be so intertwined, excuse me, does it mean that both entities can't be charged with war crimes and genocide?
Well, yes, those who are aiding the genocide under the international law, they should be charged because they are part of the genocide. Yet, physically, they are not, obviously, involved. But we do also aware that there is some military involvement by the American Marines in the beginning. Those who listen to a lot of the locals in Khan Yunis, he was actually talking to some of the soldiers who did say we are from USA, spoke to them in English. So the United States cannot just, obviously, in the end say we have nothing to do with us. They're aiding the Zionist regime, they're supplying them with their weapons, and also they're supplying them with all footages, which is telling them where is the movement of Hamas, if there is any movement. They have their own satellite there. So they are actually practically part of that genocide. But the problem is, whatever happened in the International Court or United Nations, there is no mechanism to force Israel or to punish Israel. You know, they are above the law. And when any as your guest said earlier, any time any resolution goes to the United States, it doesn't matter how many countries will vote for it, one vote, one veto, which is the United States. So that's what they, three times so far, they vetoed the ceasefire.
Right.
Just to stop the killing. It's not even involving the Israelis withdrawn from Gaza and go back to the 7th of October, obviously. They wanted actually to keep the slaughter by actually being an obstacle by stopping the slaughter of the civilians.
Well, Harley, do you think the U.S.'s proposed setup of a port off of Gaza is a ruse, as many analysts are saying, to basically empty Gaza of Palestinians and to take control of the Strip and its natural resources?
Well, I think that's a cruel hoax. The idea that you're going to put a pier out into the ocean and deliver some food, You know, the U.S. made a big deal out of dropping 38,000 meals ready to eat. 38,000 for 1.5 million starving people. You know, I think if it weren't so deadly, it would be, people would be laughing at this. But I want to go back to this question of the complicity of the United States, because the Genocide Convention of 1947-48 said that supplying weapons and support to a nation committing genocide means the nation supplying the aid and the money and the weapons is also complicit. And so under international law, if there really was a rules-based order, which Blinken keeps talking about, the United States should be brought on charges of genocide along with Israel. And the fact that it hasn't been shows the extent to which nations are afraid to turn against the unipolar order. Because the U.S., look, there's the 7th Fleet or the, whatever, the 6th Fleet is in the Mediterranean. The U.S. has proven its willingness to conduct killing in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Syria with the support of the terrorists there. So I think the problem is there's got to be a reaction in the United States and Europe. And it's important what you're doing to get the story out, because your news does get covered in the United States. They try to silence it, but the more the truth gets out, the more chance we have that we can turn this around.
Yeah, they definitely try to silence this network many times. But go ahead, John, you want to say something?
Don't forget, in the beginning of the genocide, the USA sent their military ship bordering the Lebanese shores and sent, obviously, threatening messages to the Lebanese government, to Hezbollah, not to involve. Not only they are supplying weapons, they vetoing any resolution to condemn the Zionist entity in the United Nations. They're physically, actually, and they are actually on the sea, telling Hezbollah, if you involve, we had to involve to protect Israel. So as the gentleman just mentioned, aiding and financing is part of that. But as I said earlier, there is no mechanism to force United States or Israel. In 1979, the American bombed the harbor in Nicaragua. The international law obviously decided that the American under Reagan should rebuild the harbor. So we've been waiting 45 years now. Nothing happened. You need to have enforcement to make things happen, not only spending time condemning this and condemning that and nothing happened. Palestinians after South African complained to the court, they're still being killed. That war never stopped. Hospitals are still being bombed. Schools are being bombed. So there is no mechanism to stop that unless the Palestinians and the other neighboring resistance intensify their resistance to the Zionist entity, and then that will make a big difference. A little move by Yemen, you know, a little poor country, will make a big difference. Hezbollah keeping the north area of Resi busy. We need Iraq and Syria. The only way, counting on United States government, you know, is not going to make any difference.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with us on this spotlight. Harley Schenker out of Germany, spokesman for International Schiller Institute. John Phoenix out of London, journalist and international relations expert. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, hoping to see you right here next time. Goodbye.
The Limelight. The former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said Britain is in the throes of a hidden poverty epidemic, with the worst affected households living in squalor and going without food, heating, and everyday basics. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to new food insecurity data, millions of people, including one in five families with children, have gone hungry or skipped meals in recent weeks because they could not regularly afford to buy groceries. According to the Food Foundation tracker, 15% of British households, equivalent to approximately 8 million adults and 3 million children, experienced food insecurity in the month of January, as high food prices continued to hit the pockets of low-income families. Experts warned the persistence of high levels of food insecurity among low-income families was a health emergency that would drive the prevalence of conditions linked to poor nutrition, such as malnutrition and rickets. Nearly two-thirds or 60% of food insecure households reported buying less fruit, and 44% bought fewer vegetables as they struggled with the ongoing cost of living crisis in Britain. By contrast, just 11% of food secure households bought less fruit and 6% purchased fewer vegetables. Although the Foundation has previously reported the amount of vegetables bought by British households has fallen to a 50-year low, the latest tracker data shows the situation is far worse for low-income families. Citing Guardian revelations that the National Health Service has recorded an increase in hospital admissions for nutrient deficiency, the Foundation said falling fruit and vegetable consumption among the poorest people in Britain was likely to widen health inequalities and put added strain on the National Health Service. The Foundation said, although inflation had decreased in recent months, food prices remained high. It said the price of a reasonably costed, adequately nutritious weekly basket of food has increased by 24% to 26% in the past 2 years. Food insecurity levels, based on a regular Food Foundation survey of more than 6,000 people, have fallen slightly from 17.5% in January of 2023, but remain as high as they were in the chaotic first weeks of the pandemic in 2020. The Foundation said the ongoing cost of living crisis meant food insecurity had become, in effect, the norm for many people in Britain. Millions of low-income families in Britain being unable to afford to access regular and healthy food has focused attention on the inadequacy of social security support in Britain. According to the Food Foundation's latest data, 45% of households in receipt of universal credit, the main low-income benefit, reported experiencing food insecurity. The Foundation said all children in families on universal credit should be automatically entitled to free school meals. There is increasing concern that from April, the government will discontinue the Household Support Fund, a £900 million a year hardship fund administered by English councils and widely used to fund school holiday meal vouchers for families with children on free school meals. Michael Marmot, a public health expert and professor of epidemiology at University College London, said, "There are fewer needs more basic than nutritious food for you and your children. In Britain, in 2024, one in five households with children cannot meet that basic need. They are simply too poor, and the poorer they are, the less likely they are to be able to meet that need." A government spokesperson claimed, "We recognise the pressures people are facing, which is why we are providing £104 billion in cost of living support, worth on average £3,700 per household, while our healthy food schemes are helping more than 3 million children." But Henry Dimbleby, a former government food advisor and the author of 2021 National Food Strategy, called the latest statistics a health emergency that would cast a long shadow on public health. Website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. The former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said Britain is in the throes of a hidden poverty epidemic, with the worst affected households living in squalor and going without food, heating and everyday basics such as clean clothes and toothpaste. Gordon Brown charged the Conservative government with creating a wall of silence around obscene levels of destitution in the United Kingdom, and criticised ministers for systematically shredding a social security system that had once provided a safety net for the poorest people in Britain. Gordon Brown said it was a moral outrage that the government was unwilling to tackle a social emergency that had created millions of forgotten and voiceless victims, one he compared in an article for The Guardian with the post office scandal in terms of the scale of ministerial neglect. Gordon Brown said, "In years to come, I believe people will be asking how it was that government walked by on the other side when thousands of children were suffering abject deprivation and failed to support them in their hours of need." He described the poverty he had witnessed in his hometown of Kirkcaldy in Scotland, where 70% of children were in poverty in some neighbourhoods, as the worst he had seen in his lifetime. He said in a recent interview, "In 2010, we were helping 100 children at Christmas through charity schemes. Last Christmas, it was 1,800. He described Britain as haunted by poverty we thought had been consigned to history. He said the situation was deteriorating for destitute families whose children lacked proper clothing or had to share beds, whose parents felt shame because they could not provide and feared their children would be taken into care as a result. Gordon Brown challenged Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, to use his March budget to address the suffering of families for whom 2024 was shaping up to be financially the worst year in living memory. He said, "In an advanced economy, understanding these privations shouldn't be a question of ideology, but a question of decency." Gordon Brown called on Jeremy Hunt to undertake a root and branch review of universal credit and extend the government's £900 million cost of living crisis household support fund, currently at risk of being axed from next April. The fund provides emergency help such as food vouchers, beds and cookers to struggling families. Brown's comments came as he published a review of UK hardship on behalf of his multi-bank project, a network of local charities developed out of the office of Gordon and Sarah Brown, which sources and distributes millions of surplus goods to families in need. The review predicts the current crisis, the cost of living crisis is the phrase, but the cost of staying alive crisis might be a better description, will continue for many households because food and fuel prices remain high,